Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I'm your host for the first hour. I first and foremost want to thank everybody for tuning in this weekend, and I also want to direct all of our listeners who listen on the radio and on the podcast or just tune into our website during the weekend. I highly recommend going back over this last week's bunch of interviews. I had a couple new guests on the show and a couple favorites that I think had some very interesting comments on a week that was relatively slow or had lacked volatility, at least until the end of the week. I am kicking off this show with Chris Temple, regular guest on our show, founder and editor of The National Investor. And Chris, let's get a quick comment on copper on Friday, breaking out of this short-term resistance that it was bumping its head against. I have to ask you, is this all simply because we're getting some trade talk rumors that there might be some deal or at least a memorandum of understanding between China and the U.S.?
Well, that's part of it. As you and I are recording this, of course, we don't know what the outcome of the Friday afternoon meeting is between President Trump and the special envoy of President Xi from China, Mr. Liu. We don't know how that's going to turn out Friday afternoon, whether they actually are going to come out with what's been rumored for the last 24 hours or so, this six-part memorandum of understanding. But I have to tell you, Corey, if copper is going up based on that, that's insufficient reason in my view, among other things. And you and I talked about this in a couple of our segments earlier this week, as you just mentioned. I've been writing about it previously. In the month of January alone, China threw close to $400 billion into its credit system. That is beyond anything any individual central bank pretty much has done. And all they've done is slow the rot of an economy in their country that is choking on such mountains of debt relative to the size of its economy more than anybody on this planet these days. And they have to print all this money just to maintain equilibrium. So it makes you wonder, if we get even a framework of a trade deal, how much does that really translate in the real world into China being able to again amp things up and become the overwhelming consumer of copper and all these other commodities in the world? I think people are ahead of themselves. So the one reason I think that copper would be legitimate in breaking out, and the reason why the stock market may be doing better than I certainly expected this rally to do and everything else, is because the markets are starting to sense, and I think correctly so, that the central banks are not going to wait for another 2008 style crash. They're going to start getting back to full on inflate or die mode now in the hopes of heading it off. I mean, the stuff that has come out of the Fed in the last month and a half or so is astonishing, including this week from New York Fed President John Williams.
Now, one thing that we have been talking about on this track of the Fed becoming more dovish, even though, you know what, they're at least, well, it was a bit of a surprise that they got just as dovish in that full-on pause that they have now been in for a month. But the fact of the matter is they are starting to understand something that you've said, that the Fed is the de facto central bank of the world, and they're finally starting to understand that if they see weakness in these other countries, which no doubt they have, in the major countries like China and Europe, then they might try to get ahead of it. Have we ever seen central banks try to get ahead of a recession? We usually hear about central banks leading us into recessions.
They usually do. They step on the gas too much, and then when they try and gently take away the punch bowl, it becomes abrupt. The one time in recent history, you go back to the middle 1980s and the U.S. dollar had gone into orbit for a variety of reasons. It was causing all kinds of trouble. It was causing commodity price weakness, as a strong dollar will do internationally, et cetera. And it wasn't so much the central banks, but it was the treasury officials of the leading nations got together for what was called the Plaza Accord back then. And you had this basically multifaceted, concerted manipulation back downward of the dollar, which had become too strong. That, of course, ended up being overdone. And then the dollar started to weaken, and that led to the Fed having to reverse and raise interest rates, and that caused a 1987 stock market crash ultimately. But the Plaza Court is the only time you ever saw policymakers try and short circuit something, you know, maybe a little bit on the order of what we got. But even saying that, Corey, this is a different kettle of fish. You've got, and I've said this to you more than once, you have to look at everything that we talk about now, even these trade things, which frankly, in the grand scheme of things, are a sidebar to the big picture. The big picture, the core story that people need to keep their heads around is that we have had a decade of unprecedented monetary stimulus, quantitative easing the planet over, zero interest rates, negative interest rates, et cetera, that helped to rescue us supposedly from the 2008 crash. We got a lot more traction in reblowing various asset bubbles and blowing some new ones than we did for most people where the Main Street economy is concerned. But it's all kind of pretty much run its course. And it's why the Fed had to do such an about face in its policy, because they realized that things are that over choked with debt again that they can't normalize to the extent that they thought they could maybe 6 months or a year ago. And so now we're left with this notion that to keep us, forget about rescuing us, Corey, from another crash, to keep us from going into a new one, you've got the European Central Bank that has abandoned any thought of its trying to normalize policy. It's through the back door, through its open market operations, still net doing a lot of quantitative easing. Kuroda from the Bank of Japan came out this week and said, hey, we might have to rejoin this too. We might be actually printing more money and buying more assets. I don't know what there is left to buy over there, but they'll figure it out. And last but not least, after already having such an abrupt change of policy, you're right on the in the aftermath of that, getting comments from a key person like a John Williams that the Fed is going to dust off some of its old ideas itself on what might bring about negative interest rates here in the U.S. when the time comes. They are still concerned that their measures of inflation are still stuck in the mud. They don't want that. They want to be able to create more inflation. They've done a lot of it in asset markets, but not the way they want. So you're going to see the Fed, even before we actually have a full-blown recession, country, they will reverse course. They will start easing in various ways. And though I think copper has a little bit of justification, that's why you've especially seen the strong rally in gold of late, why interest rates stay compressed. It's because people are starting to figure out that in order to keep everything from imploding again, these central banks are all in one way or another going back to what the late Richard Russell has called the inflate or die mode.
Okay, so on that point, if we do get more money printing out of all of these central banks, one, does it lead to inflation? And two, does it again just end up in financial assets?
Well, the kind of answers itself, Corey, because both of those choices are really one and the same. They, of course, come hell or high water, they don't want financial assets to deflate, because then that compromises the banking and financial system and markets themselves. Secondarily, of course, the Main Street economy. So the kind of inflation they will create will be maybe in commodity prices a bit more now going forward than what we have seen in the recent past. We've had this chronic underperformance for years in commodities compared to financial assets. That gap will close some. I think in the time ahead, it's this stagflation light environment I've been talking about. But still, people who are going to predict, and they are now, that as the Fed gets back into this, you know, just like they predicted back in 2008, 2009, and 10, gold's going to $5,000. We're going to have Germany or Venezuela or Zimbabwe-like hyperinflation because of all this money printing. We won't see that, at least certainly not here, and really in much of the rest of the developed world. What you have to keep in mind, folks, is that all of this money printing by the central banks, for the most part, is simply going to mitigate the deflation that is already starting to unfold within the markets and within economies. They just want to get an earlier start on it than they did in 2008 when it hit them all at once.
Yeah, crazy that they could be getting that far in front of a recession. But hey, that would be a change in what central banks have done in the past. Just to wrap us up with a quick comment regarding China. You and I have talked about how if some of these trade war deals come about, that would, you would think, only hurt China in terms of what they would have to concede to the U.S. Plus, if they're struggling that much, does even this money printing, which they need to print more and more to get less and less of an effect, does that even save China, or is China just in that much trouble?
China is in a lot of trouble, and people that follow it closely know this. The president of the United States knows this, which is why he has really prosecuted this trade war to the extent that he has, believing that, China is more vulnerable than the U.S., and they want to force China into several behavioral changes, as Wilbur Ross has termed it, while we have the advantage. But again, when you consider, and I've got a chart on this in my current issue, it's really scary if you think that you need to be a full-on commodity bull. You know, and I agree with all of the long-term views on base metals, especially copper, the growth of the green economy in years to come, the industrialization of a lot of the still developing world in years to come is extraordinarily bullish for copper going forward. There's no question about that. But the problem is, when at the present time, China still represents the biggest factor that the markets look at when it comes to commodity pricing. If China can't keep all the balls in the air, or let's say we get some kind of a cockamamie actual trade deal, which on most issues still kicks the can down the road, and you get a little bit of a relief rally or a little bit more of a blow off top in some of these rallies, whether for stocks or commodities or whatnot, reality sets back in. China has, you know, it's the equivalent, Corey, of going out to dinner and you eat the equivalent of 10 people's meals for supper, and people expect you can repeat that performance again because you did it last night. You can't do it. You got to digest what you ate. Well, you might get sick. You might end up in a hospital. You might bust your gut open. And that, to a great extent, is a position that China has been in. And the reason they have slowed down in their economy is they're trying to figure out how to digest all this, trying to figure out how to keep enough debts from going bad that it doesn't bring everything down. And, you know, again, long term, I love copper. I love a lot of these other stories. Near term, I think that people have got a little bit too simplistic a view of just how these various assets are not only going to be rescued, but be able to extend to rallies based just on this.
All right, Chris, always good comments. And you outline a scenario that I think some people have not accepted yet and still believe that the Fed might go down and get a couple more rate hikes in. I'm very much on the fence, but talking with you day after day, I do very much see where you stand and why you stand on what the central banks are going to have to do and what they might do getting ahead of.
Let me add this. This time last year, I made a prediction that long-term interest rates would peak in 2018, right?
I remember that.
And they did. I'm going to make a prediction now. You will not see further rate hikes in this cycle from the Fed. Write it down.
All right. It is written
down. You will not. I'm not on the fence.
Okay. I know you're not on the fence, but hey, you're getting me more onto your side. But it's an interesting back and forth. And that is going to, I believe, just dominate 2019, as in what the Fed is going to do, or if they're just going to remain on pause, or if they're even going to start printing money. Chris, it's great having you on the show. I appreciate the comments for the weekend show. Everybody stick around. I'm going to be right back with Mike Larson, continuing to focus on the U.S. equity markets.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition and continuing on with some comments on more of the broad market moves, taking a step back rather than looking at individual sectors. However, in this interview, we will be discussing some of the sectors and correlations that are a little bit confusing right now. I am chatting with Mike Larson. Mike writes the Safe Money Report over at the Weiss Ratings, and Mike has been a regular guest on our program and really outlining what's been going on, where money has been flowing in these broad markets very correctly over the last, well, few number of months since I've been having you on. And Mike, first I want to compare what's been going on with the bond market and the stock market. Stock market continuing to grind higher, coming up to some very near-term resistance as we are recording this. And the bond market, it kind of seems stuck ever since we started the year, even back to the tail end of this year. What are your comments on the relationship between the two?
Yeah, this has been one funny, abnormal, I don't know what kind of word you want to use to describe it, stock market rally. And I say that because, as you mentioned, it hasn't really been confirmed by other, you know, sectors within the market, for that matter, as well as other asset classes entirely. I mean, let's go back and look at the panic in the stock market right around Christmas week. You have the Dow that bottomed out right around 21,700, give or take. It was recently at almost 26,000. So, you know, you're talking about a move of more than 4,000 some odd points higher in the Dow off its lows. Obviously a very large magnitude move. Now let's go look at what the 10-year U.S. Treasury note yield has done. It bottomed out sort of into that panic area at around 2.56%. Earlier this week, it was trading at around 2.65%. So you're talking about a move, and just for comparison's sake, the high on the 10-year Treasury back at the end of the end of 2018 was way up around 3.25%. So you're talking about less than a 10 basis point move higher in the benchmark U.S. 10-year Treasury note, and a 4,000 plus point move higher in the Dow. I mean, I don't want to say it's completely unprecedented, but certainly it doesn't fit with anything we've seen. Not just in this entire most of the last few years in this bull market. Or in other words, the action in the bond market isn't really confirming what's happening in stocks. You know, it's more than just that, too. If you look at, say, the VIX index, it's come down. It was around 14 earlier this week. Its lows were under 10, so we're not back to testing those lows in the VIX. And we're also not seeing things that are kind of measures of global growth, like the Baltic Freight Index, which is actually not or has really bounced hardly at all or not at all, even as you've seen equities and other things that tend to rise in tandem with it rally quite a bit. So a really interesting market when you look at those kinds of things going on. One market isn't really squaring with the other. And if I had to talk about even another market that's kind of out there in left field, so to speak, it's gold. I mean, you and I have talked for some time. I've been bullish on the metal for a number of months now and the gold miners. And again, that's not because I'm a gold bug. It's just because I like the attributes of gold in this environment. But one of my main reasons for investing in gold is sort of chaos insurance, insurance against the unknown, loss of faith in some of the economic growth outlook and central bank planning and so on. And so it's interesting that what we've seen happen is gold has continued to rip higher, even though some of the other things that previously were going up along with gold, such as volatility, have stopped doing so. So again, a lot of markets are sending out different signals, and the correlations that we've had for quite some time have been breaking down. And it raises questions about which market is right. I mean, do you, as an investor, say, well, bonds are right, so I don't want to chase stocks higher here because the bonds are telling you that this economy is going to be slowing, and then inflation pressures are leaking out and so on. Do you want to, you know, trust the gold market and say, gee, it's looking at the potential for volatility to really pick up here, so I don't want to take a lot of risk? Or do you look at the stock market and say, risk? Who's worried about risk? We're up 4,000 points. So it's kind of a weird situation to be in. Personally, what I'm telling our investors and what we're doing in the Safe Money Report is sort of a mixed bag. We have a couple broad market hedges, one of which we took half off into the waterfall sell-off in December. So we made, you know, a nice quick 20% plus on that, taking on a little bit of water on the remaining position. But that's okay because the types of stocks that have been rallying are also the defensive, higher yield, higher rated stuff that make up the remainder of the investments that we do hold in Safe Money Report. For example, there's a utility called AES Corporation. corporation that I recently recommended. They've been restructuring, getting out of a lot of dumb investments they made years ago in South America and a few other places in the world. Decent yield, been cutting debt and so on. That thing's up double-digit percentages in just the last month since we added it. You know, another company that we own, One Gas, ticker symbol OGS. I mean, this is, frankly, let's admit it, a boring company that does natural gas utility service in three different states in the Midwest, Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas. Again, not really a sexy story, but it's a stock that's consistently been rising. It's got a decent dividend yield there, better than the market. And it's just been, you know, slowly and but surely climbing higher here, and it's also a double-digit gainer. So the stuff we're still long, the defensive, more safe-type investments are doing just fine. So, you know, and again, the point of bringing that up, not just because our investors are happy with it, it's that that doesn't confirm that this is a full sort of full-fledged risk-on type market where everybody's just throwing caution to the wind. Because if that were the case, they'd be dumping the safe stuff and they'd be buying FANG and they'd be buying industrials and they'd be buying all that stuff. But they're buying both, or they're, you know, they're not dumping the stuff that, that is sort of a hedge. So again, very odd environment. And I think that that just speaks to the changing nature of this market, and that you don't want to be going all in anymore like you might have between, you know, or in the few years after the election when everything was pointed higher.
So you bring up a lot of good points where you can make the argument for risk on assets that have been moving higher, that that might continue, or these risk off assets that have been moving higher, that that could continue. But we can't expect that we're going to be in a long-term situation where everything is rising, unless, who knows, we're in just a completely different market and there's a lot more liquidity than anybody ever thought. What key maybe breakouts or breakdowns are you going to be watching to confirm one bullish case over the other?
Well, let's look at it this way. I was kind of expecting, you know, expecting a rally from deeply oversold territory in December, and my upside target for the S&P was in the mid to high 2600s. You know, we're about 100 points above that, but obviously that was after traveling 350 some odd points from the low. So I started pulling back, not chasing, whatever you want to call it, this market bounce once we got into that zone. So, you know, I captured, or my view captured multiple percentage points, but maybe not the last couple. Now we're kind of in this stall zone, just under 2800. In the S&P, that I think is very important, and, you know, corresponds to roughly 26,000 on the Dow. You know, I'm very, very intrigued to see if we get any confirmation whatsoever from the bond market that the stocks are right, or if the stock market is just trading in rarefied air here. I actually this week took off a small cap position that I have in a different service, but this thing was down double digits as a result of the sell-off last year, and it surged more than 42% just since the first of the year. I mean, let's be frank, that's nuts. As much as I might like this company's long-term story, you know, it's a small cap that kind of got swept up in this bounce and was up 42%. I said, to heck with it, let's take the profit. You know, we went from a double-digit loss to a solid single-digit gain, you know, bank that basically. And my idea in doing that is I think this rally has carried us about as far as it can, you know, on this talk of China trade concessions and this, you know, this idea that the Fed's moved to neutral and so on. So I just want to take the money and run and now reevaluate. I think that's what we have to do here, you know, see where things are going next. The stuff I would still buy or still recommend, again, is defensive type things, not financials, not materials. It would be things like gold, gold miners, higher yield, defensive type names, utilities, consumer staples, select REITs. I mean, all that, those types of investments I've been pushing all year that have been working very well for investors, I don't see any reason to change that. The only thing that would change my view is if some, you know, something were to come along and change the economic cycle, which I just don't think is possible at this point. We've had a credit exhaustion. We've seen the credit cycle begin to turn where lenders are beginning to pull back in terms of their willingness to make consumer and business loans. We've seen corporate spreads start to widen out, indicating you know, more fear about defaults. And even with the big stock market rally, you know, we've seen those spreads come in a little bit, but nothing like that gets us back to sort of that ridiculous risk-loving situation we were in about a year ago. So, yeah, I still want to be somewhat defensive, carry more higher cash levels, invest in sectors and investments that can do well even in a tougher economy. And nothing that, you know, I've seen in the stock market changes that. The only thing, like I said, that would change my view entirely is if the bond market starts confirming that, you know, the worst of the slowdown's behind us. And I just don't think that's going to happen, especially not, you know, essentially a decade into a bull market and, you know, the longest economic expansion in U.S. history.
Yeah, one more quick point just to wrap it up on. If you are thinking and if you are playing that side of at least holding a bigger cash position, seeing how some of these things play out, plus also seeing the struggles that could very well be ahead for the U.S. economy and the U.S. markets, does that support a strong dollar or at least a dollar maintaining in the mid to high 90s?
I think the issue with the dollar here really is that the foreign economies, whether you're talking about China that's been slowing, whether you're talking about Europe that, you know, you're in recession in Italy and on the verge of it in some of the core European countries, you know, things aren't great in the U.S., and I do think that the economy is going to be decelerating, but I think things in many other parts of the world are even worse. So it's kind of a situation where, you know, it's a whole least dirty shirt type theory with the dollar. You know, your choices are the dollar or something else, and unfortunately the something else, currencies aren't really all that attractive. So I think, you know, I think that gold is a great alternative in that situation. And I also think that it's worth pointing out that gold and the dollar have generally been going up at the same time. I tended to characterize that as being part of this volatility play, and I don't see any reason to kind of change that approach. I mean, I've been long gold, and you know, in terms of recommendations in the portfolio. And I've also been saying, you know, there's no reason to short the dollar here either. And I think both viewpoints have tended to play out. So I think if anything, we're likely to see that continue. And if anything, the sort of odd man out is volatility here.
All right. Hey, Mike, always great having you on the show. If anybody wants to follow along with Mike, you can do that on Twitter as well, @RealMikeLarson. It's a value having you on the show, Mike. I really appreciate that level-headed approach that you take to a wide range of sectors. Mike, have a great rest of your weekend, and everybody stick around. I'm going to be right back, and we are going to be focusing a little bit more on the precious metal sector. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Oh, welcome back. Continuing on with the weekend edition of the KE Report. As I promised in the last segment, we are switching our focus a little bit more to the precious metals, and I am chatting with Jordan Roiburn, founder and editor of The Daily Gold. Jordan joins me on every Wednesday to record an update on the technicals that he is watching, but I wanted to save this interview for the weekend show because there are some key developments and key relationships that we need to be watching as precious metals investors to confirm a potential breakout that could be coming. Jordan, break down some of the relationships that you are watching, whether it's gold to other markets or some of the gold stocks to other markets or other sectors in the resources that you think are crucial for a breakout to be confirmed.
Okay, well, Corey, what we really want to look for is relative strength in the precious metals complex. And I would offer you three things. You know, as the complex gets close to important resistance, you know, mainly gold, especially, but secondarily, we can look at GDX and GDXJ, which, you know, GDX has, you know, my near-term target is 25 for GDX and then 37.50 for GDXJ. I think if gold's going to break out, the miners would probably break above those levels. But so those are the resistance levels along with in gold. I mean, it could be 1370, it could be 1360. I mean, it's stopped at those various levels over the last 2.5 years or so. But there's three things I'm going to be looking for. The two key intermarket relationships, number one, how are precious metals performing versus stock market? So look at how gold's performing against the S&P 500. You can also look at, you know, how is GDX performing against the S&P 500? How's GDXJ performing against the S&P 500? And just I'll quickly say those things against the stock market, they have come back a little bit. And so that's something I really am going to be watching closely over the days and weeks ahead. Are we going to see the stock market come off and then gold get even stronger and benefit if the stock market weakens? That would be a really good sign. The second thing that I want to watch for is how are the gold stocks performing relative to gold? That's also a leading indicator. And I really like how those charts are setting up. I don't have them in front of me, But if you look at GDX against gold, the GDXJ against gold, all the chartists out there, look at those charts, put on a 200-day moving average. And in the last, you know, month or so, we've seen those ratios. They've hit the resistance. They've pulled back. They've gone above the resistance. They've retested it successfully. And, you know, who knows? They could be off and running if we get an extension of the strength that we've seen in recent days and weeks. So that's the second thing to watch. The third thing, of course, Corey, is breadth. I know this is leading into another answer, and I may go into one of your other questions, but I will say this is important, Corey. Yesterday, which was Tuesday, so at the Tuesday close, 81% of GDXJ and 71% of the HUI closed above the 200-day moving average. Basically, other than the middle of 2016 when, you know, we were hitting 100%, that was, as far as that indicator, that was the strongest breadth that we've seen in years and years. So that's a very good sign. But I do want to see those figures before this move peaks, whenever it might. I want to see those figures get up to 90%. That would really, really be bullish. That would tell us, you know, that's an example of real bull market breadth. Overall, I mean, over the, you know, over the last few days and weeks, I mean, we're just adding bits and bits of more bullish evidence that we're in a bull market, but, you know, we're not quite 100% confirmed. And, you know, obviously, if the, what really would confirm it would be a big breakout in gold. The monthly, one thing to watch for this month is a close above 1330. That's monthly resistance. But also next month, and we've talked about this a lot over the last couple of years, quarterly resistance. Gold's highest quarterly close is up very close to 1330. So, you know, gold is trading, you know, probably, I haven't looked at it, but probably in the 1340s right now. Can gold close March, which would be the end of the quarter, above 1330, that would be a quarterly breakout. And if that happens before it closes above, you know, 1360 or 1370, I mean, that would be a really good sign. So I know that was a long answer, but those are really all the things I'm watching right now.
Okay. So really, in general, though, seeing the stock start to outperform and seeing some monthly and longer term, even quarterly closes at or above that 1330 level, actually above that 1330 level, would at least hopefully get some more people in. One thing that you did touch on there is the percentage of, let's say, the HUI above the 200-day moving average. This deals with breadth, and this also correlates to sentiment as well. As we see sentiment move higher and even breadth move higher, that's an encouraging sign. However, some of the naysayers will say it's gone too far, it's time for a pullback. Whether it is or it isn't, pullbacks are natural. But in bull markets, it's something to remember that you get into oversold or high sentiment or high breadth measurements time and time again. So just starting to get into these situations, and who knows, maybe even building a bit higher as we approach the end of the week, this is much more bull market behavior than we've had in years, really dating back to just a few months in 2016.
Yeah, Corey, that's a fantastic point. You're absolutely right. And you're right that, you know, we don't know if the market's going to keep going and break out or pull back here. I mean, we can't predict the future. But what we do know is let's just presume that gold is going to break out at some point sooner rather than later. Let's just say some point this year. Then you're going to see extremes as far as sentiment indicators and momentum indicators. So when a market shifts its primary trend, those indicators and thing, you know, the overbought and oversold extremes and those levels that you were using over the last year or two, those are not going to work when a market is shifting its primary trend, as we could be seeing here with precious metals. And so that's something to keep in mind. I would not be worried about, you know, sentiment getting too bullish or certain things getting too overbought because of all those points that we just made. So it's look, we just have to step back and observe the market very carefully and try and do the best we can to assess if a breakout looks imminent or if we get, you know, a pullback for a couple weeks or a month or two, and if the pullback is looking, bullish and we get a bullish consolidation, you know, that would give us a little bit more evidence that we should be anticipating a breakout. But, you know, overall, Corey, I'm not concerned about you know, I looked at the COT data, and because of the government shutdown, I mean, it's still delayed by a couple of weeks. But I looked at it, and I think the last reading that I had, and I made a point of this in my weekend update, it really wasn't. I think gold was with the last reading. I think it was at my, you know, my net spec position for gold was around 26%, 25%. I think gold was, I want to say 1310 or maybe 1315. So that's really not extreme. And if you look at it, historically over the last 15 years, the peaks in that reading were 55% to 60%. And also, if you look at the major breakouts that gold has had, there's really three of them, 2005, 2007, and 2009. The net spec position at all those points was around 50%. So as we were saying before, the sentiment based on the COT, it was already really bullish right before gold made these major breakouts. So, and it looks like we're not that, you know, if I had to guess right now, we're probably in the 40s. Now, I could be wrong. That's just a guess. We're not going to know for another week or two. But I'm not that concerned about sentiment, you know, causing a big correction here. It's probably, if we get some kind of correction, it's more technical resistance. I already mentioned, the resistance levels in my last answer, and I'll throw in silver. If silver can break above 16, it has some resistance in the low 17s. So the market has moved decently over the last couple months, and it's running into strong resistance levels. That, more so than sentiment, tells me that, you know, we're probably going to see a pullback sooner rather than later. And, you know, how deep the pullback goes, how long it lasts, that's going to give us a better idea of, you know, is gold going to have a chance to break out in the next couple months, or is the next chance going to be later in the year?
Yeah, one encouraging thing I think too about the way that breadth and sentiment have risen to these levels is it's been gradual. It's taken about 5 months really for these levels to get where they are, and it's been a nice kind of stair-stepping pattern. So I also think that's encouraging, but as you said, it does foretell eventually some sort of a natural pullback, but at least it's coming off of some more bullish factors. You even mentioned silver there, and I know reading through some of your recent updates, it seems like you're paying a little bit more attention to some of the silver stocks. Can you share with us maybe some of what you look for in silver stocks if you think that silver is ready to get moving?
Well, you know, recently I did buy one silver company, and I'm going to try and tease it here without mentioning it, but there's so few primary silver companies out there. These companies had to move into gold for the most part. But basically, I'm looking at a company. There's a huge short position on it, and I really like the technical setup. It did break out in recent days, and it's very leveraged to silver. So I looked at the business, and I did some calculations. If we get the big breakout in gold, you know, where could silver go? And based on that, you know, what's the upside potential in the stock? So that's, you know, I'm really looking for leverage. Who's going to benefit? Which silver companies are going to benefit the most from a breakout in silver? And, you know, I'd also like to look at technicals. There are some silver companies out there that have already had great runs off their lows, and I don't want to chase those immediately, just because if they've already run 70 or 80%, you know, they could go sideways for several months. So those are kind of the things that I'm looking for. I mean, on the private side, I mean, there are some junior silver companies I'm aware of that'll assuming we get a breakout, you probably will see a handful of private deals go public that are focused on silver. So, you know, I'm a little bit more focused on those just because there's a real dearth of options out there. So, you know, basically it's just it's leverage. That's what I'm looking for. You know, which companies are going to benefit the most from an explosive move in silver? So, that's what it is. And there's not a whole lot of options out there. And then the second thing I'd be looking for is value. And, you know, there could be a lot of value in really the worst optionality plays, but the lowest grade, the companies that have the lowest grade silver deposits, you know, keep an eye on those, because look, if we're going to have a big breakout and start a bull market, I mean, there are things that are at 10, 15 cents that could go to 50 cents or even a dollar. Look, there's things that have already moved, and if we get a correction, you know, those things will correct, consolidate. you might have a chance to buy those cheaper. But also look at the things that haven't moved. I'm not saying you should buy everything that hasn't moved, but you might be able to find one or two hidden gems that haven't moved yet. So, I mean, that's what I would be looking for.
All right. Hey, Jordan, good chatting with you. Thanks for sharing some of your technical updates for this weekend show. As I mentioned, I feature Jordan every Wednesday on our website, kereport.com, and we always update the technicals, what he's watching, and some of these background indicators. Jordan, have a great rest of your weekend. If you want more information on Jordan's service, go to thedailygold.com. Thanks, Jordan. Welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the KE Report weekend show. We are going to continue our discussion regarding resource companies, and I am chatting with Giant Bhandari. He is a regular guest on the show, and I think a number of you know about Giant and the work he does for some of the well-known names in the mining sector in terms of the buy side. Giant, I want to first start off by talking about news that just broke, or maybe more of a rumor that just broke on Friday, and that is Barrick considering a hostile takeover of Newmont. This is just continuing on with this consolidation of majors, Newmont Gold Corp, Barrick Randgold. What do you have to say about this theme that popped up just a few months ago where the majors, it's becoming, well, fewer and fewer of them as they seem to be combining forces?
Thanks for having me, Corey. Corey, I'm very happy with what is happening in the gold mining sector right now. Particularly because Mark Bristow is leading this effort to consolidate the major gold mining companies. The major gold mining companies have been huge wealth destroyers in the gold mining sector. And the only exception in that sector, in my view, was Randgold, which was run by Mark Bristow. Mark Bristow, based on my interactions with him, it seems very clear to me, is a person who is very focused on creating value. He's focused on creating profit for his investors. He's focused on creating wealth, which means that he does not buy projects or invests in projects for promotional purposes. He's not trying to produce ounces. He's trying to produce profit. And that will, if it continues in the gold major mining sector, will mean that profit will become a focus for these gold mining companies, and that will put a huge amount of pressure on other gold mining companies to start focusing on profitability, which means that it will clean up a lot of sins and ills that this sector suffers from.
Hey, it'd be nice to finally see some proper management run these companies, because that's one thing that I know many investors have argued about, that mining companies are not run profitably or really intelligently to maximize what should be the end goal, and that is profitability. How quickly do you think that Mark could turn around this these majors and this sector in general? I know that when you have these majors, it does take a while to get everything in order and to start getting the balance sheet and income statement on a better track. Are you expecting next quarter to be better numbers, or do you think this might take until maybe the end of the year or even into 2020?
I think cleaning up the sector will take a very long time. But what I'm interested in is for him to start putting forces at play in the gold mining sector, which is start to clean up the sector. As the sector starts getting cleaned up, it will start to show in capital gains in my portfolio. And that is what interests me. It might take a while, but as long as the sector starts getting cleaned up, I'm very happy that he might be actually starting to do that.
So some of the comments in the meantime, as the cleanup hopefully does happen in the majors, a lot of people have started to look to these streaming companies and royalty companies as a sweet spot. They have money and they can make some transactions happen while some of these majors might be a little bit distracted. Do you share that view?
I am not so sure, Corey. I think streaming companies are completely different kinds of companies. They are more like banking and financing companies. So I don't think it will directly have any effect on streaming companies, what gold mining sectors is doing to the sector. But if the overall health of the sector improves as a result, I think everyone will be beneficiary of that, except for the promoters and wealth destroyers and people who live a lifestyle based on fooling investors in this sector.
Now, unfortunately, there are still a number of those companies out there. But even before this news of the Barrick possibly going hostile on Newmont, I did want to ask you what your strategy has been and is currently while investing in some of these juniors. You always bring to us some different ideas of companies that seem pretty ignored, but you see very straightforward value propositions in investing.
Corey, what I like to focus on for my portfolio is on companies that offer me value compared to the price I pay to get those companies. And value is based on valuation on projects that I do. Now, a lot of retail investors spend far too much time worrying about the macros of the world economy. Now, that is perfectly fine if you are playing with billions of dollars, but if you are playing with a few hundred thousand dollars or few tens of thousands of dollars, it makes much more sense to focus on small penny stock companies that just offer simple, boring value. And this value can be easy 50, 100% upside if they pay close attention to some of these companies.
Giant, can you share any of these companies that you're looking at right now?
Sure. Let me mention three companies to you. One is a company called Maritime Resources. The ticker is MAE. And today there has been a sell-off in this company. This is trading at 9 cents. Now remember, this is a company which was facing a hostile takeover last year. Based on the offer that the company had last year, it is worth about 15 cents and it's trading at 9 cents. My view is that the management has changed now of Maritime Resources. And as a result, there is very likely to be a consolidation happening in that area, which means a merger, a likely merger between three companies, which is Maritime Resources, Anaconda, and Rambler. If that happens, I should make anything between 100 to 150% upside based on the current 9 cent share price of Maritime Resources. Now, there's another company, Corey, IDM Mining. The ticker is IDM and the share price is 5.5 cents. There's about 20% arbitrage upside based on its merger with Ascot Resources. Now, that's a very good upside for me. I'm happy to invest. That provides me very minimal downside risk with a nice 20% or more upside by the time the merger is over. The last company I want to mention is a company called Keras Resources, which trades in London. The ticker is KRS. It's trading at 0.33 pence. Now, based on the cash value that the company has, there is about 70% upside is in owning Keras Resources. Of course, all these these three companies are very illiquid, so you have to give limit orders. Keras has promised to return the liquid shares that it owns of in its portfolio back to the shareholders, which means that I should book my 70% upside in about 6 months' time, and then I will have free upside from an African project Keras Resources has. So, these are the kind of companies that I invest in as a small investor. And as long as I'm positioning myself in a way that my downside risk is well protected and I have a nice upside, I should, as a portfolio, perform well.
Okay, so you mentioned 6 months as a time frame that you think Keras Resources could provide you with that 70% upside. Is that the time frame you usually take when looking at either some of these arbitrage opportunities or the disconnect between cash in the bank, shares on the balance sheet, and where the share price stands?
Well, ideally, I want to invest for as short term as possible. So any investor who thinks he invests for the long term is taking a wrong psychological and emotional position. If I think something is going to perform for me in 3 years from now, means that I should actually invest in that company 2.5 years from now. What I want to do is I want to invest in a company that offers me a nice value for the price I'm paying, and then just wait for that a trigger to happen. And if I can see a trigger happening in the short term, yes, that's the kind of companies I'm very keen on investing in.
Now, what about exploration companies, companies that have a drill program underway? Are you not interested in speculating on those type of plays?
Absolutely. We have talked about a company called Novo Resources. The ticker is NVO. It's stagnating at around $2.30 Canadian these days. I am a large investor in Novo Resources. Very happy to invest. I'm very happy to invest with what I consider to be a great management working on what I consider to be a very good project. There is another company that I have increasingly taken an interest in. It's a company called Miramont Resources. It recently did financing at 35 cents, but it has gone up a bit. So I would, if I had to buy more, I would wait for it to fall back to 35 cents. But they are drilling in Peru, and it's a very exciting project in my view. So yes, I do invest in companies like these as well. I create a whole portfolio, which means that I have I position for myself for a nice upside in certain companies, but all companies must provide me a very good downside risk support.
Yeah, that's important in this sector, making sure that the downside is relatively limited. You can never guarantee just how limited that downside is, but always important to keep an eye on what potentially that pullback price could get to. Giant, great having you on the show. If anybody has any questions for Giant and wants us to look at any certain companies, please email me at fleck@kereport.com, and I'm happy to bring Giant on a more regular basis to look at some of these companies that some of you are more interested in. Everybody, thanks for tuning in to the first hour of the weekend show. I hope you all enjoyed this first hour. And as I just mentioned, please keep in touch, fleck@kereport.com. I hope everybody has a great weekend. Giant, same goes for you. Thanks for taking some time this weekend.
Thanks for the opportunity, Corey. Have a great weekend.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.